Iran condemns U.S. sanctions on four Iranian nationals, saying the Biden administration is pursuing the failed policy of its predecessor. Hamas says protests in the Gaza Strip will continue until Israel lifts its siege of the territory. Israeli forces have killed three Palestinian protesters since last weekend. A funeral procession is held in the holy Iraqi city of Karbala for senior Shia cleric Ayatollah Sayyid al-Hakim, who passed away on Friday. Hello and welcome, Madam Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Tehran has lashed out at Washington for imposing sanctions on four Iranian nationals. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the current U.S. administration is unfortunately pursuing the same failed policy of its predecessor. He said U.S. officials are resorting to, quote, Hollywood-style scenarios to maintain their sanctions-driven existence. His remarks came after Washington blacklisted four Iranian intelligence operatives for an alleged kidnapping conspiracy on U.S. soil. The U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions target all property of the four individuals in the United States or in U.S. control and prohibits all transactions with them. They were alleged to be hatching a plot to abduct an anti-Tehran figure in July. Journalist and commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh believes that the U.S. imposing restrictions against Iran recently shows that Washington's sanctions policy has failed.
Here is a point that it shows us a number of things. I mean, this new allegation that they have raised. First of all, they don't have anything on Iran. Second, because they are going after such naive plot and plotting, and imitating Obama, old-fashioned Obama-style, you know, plotting against Iran. The point in here is that they don't have anything else to sanction. Apparently, some people say that they have Tehran's trees to sanction. They have sanctioned everything they could. And we are now 1.5 years after the peak of efficiency period of the sanctions, and they know it. So they are empty-handed. A look at the sanctions could tell you that. A third point is that this could also be a move to silence domestic opposition by Republicans and others who are critic of the Biden administration's foreign policy.
The Palestine resistance movement, Hamas, says the protests in the Gaza Strip will continue until Israel lifts its siege of the Palestinian territory. Hamas spokesman Abdul Latif Al-Fanu said the Palestinian nation wants the blockade on Gaza to be fully removed and will not accept gradual measures in this regard. He said Palestinians have unlimited options to put pressure on Israel to end the blockade. His remarks came after another violent night of clashes between anti-siege protesters and Israeli troops. Three people have been killed and dozens of others wounded since the anti-Israel protests began last weekend. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The Russian military says Syrian air defenses had intercepted most of the missiles Israel fired toward Damascus on Friday. 21 out of the 24 rockets fired by Israeli warplanes using Lebanese airspace were said to be destroyed mid-air before reaching their targets. Damascus issued another call to the United Nations to condemn the Israeli regime's attacks. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the call in letters addressed to the UN Secretary General and the President of the Security Council. It also urged the international bodies to discharge their responsibilities to hold Israel accountable and to prevent the repetition of such attacks. Israel regularly targets positions inside of Syria, especially those of the resistance forces who have played a key role in fighting foreign-backed terrorism. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Mehdad has received a delegation from Lebanon's caretaker government in Damascus. Now, this is the highest-level visit from Lebanon to Syria in a decade. Our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, brings us more.
The delegation was received by by Syria's foreign minister Faisal al-Assad. This is the most significant, perhaps, visit for Lebanese officials to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It includes ministers from the Lebanese government over there, including the foreign and defense minister, also the ministers of energy, finance, defense, also the general directorate of general security, and the delegation is headed by the vice prime minister. Currently, there is a meeting being held, an official meeting, their first meeting here at the foreign ministry where I am right now. The delegation is officially meeting with the Syrian foreign minister, Dr. Faisal al-Maqdad. The purpose of the meeting is to boost economic relations and cooperation with Syria, reactivate them, actually. In fact, this is perhaps the best word to describe what is happening. Also, according to some sources at the Lebanese Ministry of Finance over there, they said that the aim is also to discuss with Syria reactivating the 2009 deal on having the Egyptian gas reach from Egypt all the way to Syria and then reach Lebanon. So the purpose of the visit in general is to reactivate economic relations between both countries, especially in light of the economic slowdown over there in Lebanon.
A funeral procession has been held for senior Iraqi Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammed Sayyid al-Hakim. Mourners converge on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala on Saturday to bid farewell to the eminent religious figure. Meanwhile, condolences are pouring in over the passing of Ayatollah al-Hakim. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian expressed deep sorrow, describing his demise as a great loss. Several Iraqi officials, including President Barham Saleh and Secretary General of Parliament Serwan Abdallah, also sent condolence messages. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah also called Ayatollah Hakim's demise a major loss for the world of Islam. The top cleric passed away at the age of 87. He was among the four prominent religious figures in Iraq and taught at the religious seminary of Najaf alongside top cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Clashes have been ongoing between the Taliban and forces loyal to local leader Ahmed Massoud in Afghanistan and Panjshir province, with both sides claiming to have inflicted casualties on each other. Anti-Taliban fighters in Panjshir says they have pushed back attacks and injured hundreds of Taliban forces. Massoud supporters say the Taliban launched attacks from four different directions but have been unable to reach the valley. That is while the Taliban deny casualties on their side. Now, the group says it has advanced well into Panjshir and unofficially claims to have fully taken the valley after defeating resistance forces there. Celebratory gunfire was heard across the capital, Kabul, after Taliban sources say they have seized Panjshir. The valley has been the only territory in Afghanistan that has put up resistance against the Taliban after the group's takeover of the country in mid-August. The group swept through Afghanistan days after the U.S. announced that it was withdrawing from the country after two decades. All American troops and forces of their allies have already evacuated the country. Now, Turkey has demanded the EU establish a new deal over the Afghan refugees. Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says Ankara will not accept a certain amount of money from the EU while leaving the burden of the refugees to Turkey. Rashan Saglam reports from Istanbul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish foreign minister said in a joint presser with Dutch foreign minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse. Assuring that international cooperation is needed, to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan. The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The U.S. is facing criticism over the manner it withdrew its troops from Afghanistan. Now, Washington's superpower status is being questioned by its closest ally, Britain. What does that mean for the U.S., its strategic partners, and the rest of the world? It appears there are cracks in the U.S. military adventurism with its closest allies, including the EU.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Billions of dollars spent and thousands of lives lost during a 20-year-long war, but it couldn't change the facts on the ground in Afghanistan the way the U.S. had intended. The aftermath of the U.S.-led war and its failures are leading some European nations like the U.K. to reconsider forming a new military force without relying on Washington.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as the safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States.
Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe, with its colonial history, it's certainly, you know, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Australia registers another record-breaking number of new coronavirus infections. Health officials logged over 1,700 new COVID cases. And the state of New South Wales reported the bulk of these infections, with over 1,500 new cases and four deaths. Recent daily infections are running about double the levels of Australia's previous worst wave a year ago. The states of Victoria, New South Wales, and the Australian Capital Territory have been under strict lockdowns for weeks. Officials are urging people to get vaccinated, warning that the worst is yet to come. Authorities in New South Wales and Victoria say that vaccination is key in controlling the outbreak, and they are speeding it up. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced a wholesale review and declassification of files from the investigation into the 9/11 attacks in response to intense pressure from Congress and victims' families currently suing Saudi Arabia. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Joe Biden tells FBI to release files on 9/11 investigation and possible Saudi links. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced a wholesale review and declassification of files from the investigation into the 9/11 attacks in response to intense pressure from Congress and victims' families currently suing Saudi Arabia. As the 20th anniversary of 9/11 approaches, the American people deserve to have a fuller picture of what their government knows about those attacks, an executive order issued on Friday, 3rd of September, said. It said the full record would be disclosed in tranches over the coming 6 months, except when the strongest possible reasons counsel otherwise. The order said that while the indiscriminate release of information could jeopardize national security and the ability to prevent future attacks, a better balance had to be struck between transparency and accountability. It said information should not remain classified when the public interest in disclosure outweighs any damage to national security. Victims' families have long demanded the U.S. release the findings of Operation Encore, an FBI investigation into possible Saudi complicity, particularly contacts between Saudi Arabian officials and two 9/11 hijackers who lived in California in the months before the attacks. Riyadh has denied any involvement in the hijacking and is fighting a lawsuit brought by the families of 9/11 victims in federal court of law in New York. President Biden's executive order comes a month after legislation was introduced with bipartisan support in Congress, demanding greater transparency in the investigation. "I'm very excited," said Terry Strada, whose husband Tom died in the attack on the World Trade Center, and who is the co-chair of a families and survivors group, 9/11 Community United. "I'm thrilled that we have an executive order now that will mandate a full declassification review of all of the documents." Terry Strada added, "The onus is now on the intelligence agencies to explain why they're going to classify a document. The way that they've been doing it until now is under cover of darkness. They won't be able to do that any longer." Under the executive order, an FBI electronic communication dated 4th of April 2016 would have to be released by 11th of September. The family's lawyers believe that to be a 16-page summary of Operation Encore findings. The existence of that document was admitted by the U.S. government during the discovery process in the New York case, but its contents were not disclosed. Within 2 months of the order, the FBI and other agencies will have to release all other records that previously were withheld as classified, in full or in part, during discovery, as well as another FBI electronic communication closing Operation Encore. Within 4 months, the government will declassify all interview reports, analytical documents, documents reporting investigative findings, or other substantive records, including phone records and banking records, if any, from the FBI's original investigation into the attacks, known as Pent Bomb, where there is any relevance to Operation Encore. Within 6 months, the U.S. government must release anything relevant from any other investigation which concerns the hijackers and any relationship with a foreign government. It will be up to the Attorney General or the heads of the FBI and other agencies to prove that the release of any information reasonably could be expected to result in damage to national security. The significant events in question occurred 2 decades ago or even longer, and they concern a tragic moment that continues to resonate in American history and in the lives of so many Americans, the executive order states. It is therefore critical to ensure that the United States government maximizes transparency, relying on classification only when narrowly tailored and necessary. The declassification is unlikely to resolve all of the unanswered questions surrounding the 9/11 plot. President Biden's executive order comes only a day after a complaint by the families to the Justice Department Inspector General over the FBI's claim to have lost critical evidence, allegedly including photographs and videotape of hijackers with Saudi officials, records of witness interviews, and phone records of conversations among the 9/11 hijackers. Brett Eagleson, whose father, Bruce Eagleson, was killed in the attacks, said the families will be watching to see that the declassification is comprehensive. "President Biden is asking us to trust the administration will bring justice to the 9/11 community, and we certainly hope this is a genuine step towards that," Eagleson said in a written statement. The statement added, "We will closely watch this process to ensure the Justice Department and FBI follow through, act in good faith, and help our families uncover the truth in our pursuit of justice against the Saudi Arabian government. The first test will be on 9/11, and the whole world will be watching."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
We've discussed in the previous episode how the JCPOA was formed by the P5+1, and then they put all their stipulations into it. The rest is history. We know what happened. Iran was, you know, it was loyal to the whole thing. It stood by the contract. But then this donkey Trump comes along, he rips up the whole thing. Even though we had now poured concrete into our centrifuges and just destroyed all of the facilities even. So some are advocating that we rejoin the JCPOA, that Iran rejoins the JCPOA. Others are arguing that, no, this is not the right strategy to take. What are your thoughts on this, Sayyid Mahdi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's an interesting subject, you know. First of all, I think there's some preliminary things that do need to be set out there, and that is that the United States of America and the American government was the one who unilaterally left this comprehensive plan of action, this JCPOA. They unilaterally left it. They, for all intents and purposes, spit in the face of all of the people who were in this JCPOA, which includes the UK and France, Germany, Russia, and China. So for all intents and purposes, they spit on the face of every single one of these countries, and they said that despite the fact that we signed this thing together, we all agreed to the things that were within the plan of action, that still we're going to unilaterally come out of it. We don't care about what anybody else in the world says, you know. And so they left. This is one thing on itself. But what's interesting, and this is a question that Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei has also asked and he's constantly talked about. He says, well, fine, if the United States of America wanted to leave the JCPOA, what did the rest of the parties do?
Mm.
Now, he's not necessarily talking about Russia and China, because Russia and China did, you know, in some places speak up a little bit and say that, yeah, this is not good and you should rejoin. But he's talking about the other three partners, which is the UK, Germany, and France. So these three European nations, they themselves did not bother to fulfill their commitments within the JCPOA. They did not bother to stand up to the United States of America when it unilaterally left and destroyed a deal which all of these countries worked on. And the United Nations has also approved this thing. So this is now a global agreement that was approved. It's not just 5+1 countries. It's a global agreement. The European nations didn't do anything. They didn't bother to step in and help Iran. They came up with some excuses like Instex and these kind of things, which never worked, right? If you look at it historically, these things never worked. It was just a weak play on European governments. So this is an important preliminary when we're speaking about who should return to the JCPOA first, right? When you are seeing that, you know, the UK, the US, France and Germany not only did nothing, but one of them left the JCPOA, it seems pretty clear that who is at fault in this whole game.
Yeah, no, that was a fantastic analysis, actually. Sheikh Ali?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the question we should be asking is, who left JCPOA and why?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Before we get to the point where, you know, we say who should return to it first or after or, you know, together, simultaneous, you know, all of that stuff. I think the question should be, who broke this deal? Who did not fulfill their side of the deal?
Mm-hmm.
And who filled their side of the deal? And who sticked to the agreement? Well, in this case, the Islamic Republic of Iran not only did, you know, stick to their commitments, but also, even after the U.S. left the deal, they kept saying, the Islamic Republic kept saying that we have not left the deal. Why are you leaving the deal? What is it wrong with you?
Yeah.
And then, as Sayyid has pointed out, the European countries, they had a role to play here. But the problem is they are too subservient and too scared of the big bully that is the great Satan, the United States of America. So they, instead of, you know, putting America under pressure for not leaving this deal, on which the deal itself, a lot of efforts were spent from all these countries and all these nations,
yeah.
right? There was a lot at stake, and it's really irresponsible of the United States of America to just unilaterally walk away, you know, as if it was nothing. It was like, you know, child's play. So instead of pushing the U.S. to fulfill its side of commitment, the European countries, too, they're like, you know, yeah, whatever, you know, as if nothing happened. This is very irresponsible for those so-called world powers, you know, who want to portray as if they are superpowers, which we never agreed with, and we have talked about it in the past, too.
Do you know what? It shows that they take each other seriously, but not Iran.
Honestly, they don't even take each other seriously. But
that's
yes,
a good point
if
well,
you
yeah.
want to draw a parallel and comparison, yeah, they are just not serious with what happens in the world, what
they don't
unfolds
feel like
in the world,
yeah,
what the nations go through, right?
Mm.
How many people die of poverty and hunger? They're not concerned about that. This is not what their passion is, right? They're all concerned about their control, their monopoly, their authority, their financial control, their control on the culture of every nation and every country. This is what they're after. They just want to change the whole dynamics of this world based on their own understanding of things rather than being serious about humanity. So, you know, the United States of America walked away from the deal unilaterally, and it is not a topic of dispute, right? It is an insult to all the countries that were part of this deal. It's an official insult. It's an insult to the United Nations. It is an insult to all the countries of the world, because when there is a conflict going on between these big super and regional powers, countries get affected.
Yeah.
It is an insult to all the nations, and this is the very nature of the United States of America, this falling empire, this arrogance, right? They do not care what the price is. You know, look at Trump, how he has made decisions throughout his tenure, right? And Biden is, by the way, no different, right? They're all the same. It's a system. It's a system of arrogance, right? So the United States of America walked away. Hence, if anything, it should come back. Now, it's a separate topic whether we want to even have the deal in the first place and what the stance of the leader was. That's a separate topic. We're not getting into that. Just looking at the surface level, there was a deal that took place under whatever conditions. The deal was fulfilled by Iran, and the deal was not fulfilled by America and its cohorts, right? So who should come back to the deal? It's the United States of America, and not just come back. It must apologize to the world and to the Islamic Republic of Iran for what it has done. But it won't do it, you know. It's just too arrogant for that.
What do you see? Tell me, what do you taste? Tell me, what do you hear when I whisper your name? You see through my eyes and turn me away. In madness, you'd spiral if I did the same. Ooh, my love, I'm waiting.
IRIB English Radio.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Shadowless, don't see me. Shadowless, as I can be. Shadowless, don't see me.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing here, right? So we have now established that it is the United States of America that needs to come back to this deal, because they're the ones who broke the deal, they're the ones who left the deal. So.
And again, if anything, it's not that we're looking to have a deal with them.
Yeah,
that's
a
separate topic.
It's very interesting, right? The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he says that, first off, we don't insist that they come back to the deal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And two, we're in no rush for them to come back to the deal.
That's right.
Meaning, for us, it's not a big deal. You want to come to the deal. You don't want to come,
get
lost.
And from day one, we were actually not interested in the deal to begin with. You know, the revolutionaries were never interested in it, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing is, like, the deal happened. They want to come back. Okay, well, we'll see. And now the leader has put a red line. He has said that unless all the sanctions are lifted 100% completely, not just, you know, a few of the sanctions and, you know, the few other get put on, the few gets taken off. That's you know, just childish. The leader has said that all the sanctions must be removed as a prerequisite if the deal has to continue now.
And this is what's interesting. I was going to bring it here that, for example, the UK, France, and Germany, Western countries in general, plus the United States of America, all of these guys, they have a vested interest with each other, right? They have a common denominator, and this is this anti-Islamic sentiment, right?
They're actually enemies on the same team. They're enemies of each other, but they're on the same team.
Right. It's interesting. For example, if I want to connect with your example, it was the War of Ahzab, right? Or the defense of Ahzab, which is also known as the Confederates. And so this is when the pagans and some of the Jewish tribes of Medina and pretty much everybody who was against Islam came together in a united front to fight Islam, even though they had differences. They were enemies of each other, right?
That's when they realized that.
The Jews of Medina did not like the polytheists of Mecca and vice versa, but right. On this common enmity, they came together. And here you will find that they have come in this common enmity of Islam, this very anti-Islamic behavior, this enmity to Islam that they have. And you can go, you know, one by one into different things. Just to bring up France, the cartoons that they released, their defense of these very ugly cartoons, their ban on the niqab or their ban on religious symbols in public places, whether it's schools or government buildings. So all of these guys come together, right? And one of the things that really threw me off was in this JCPOA when the United States of America left, and then the U.S., the United States government under Donald Trump started to sanction the Islamic Republic Iran of Iran left and right, okay? These European countries, why didn't they speak up when the Islamic Republic of Iran, despite abiding by all of its JCPOA commitments, was being sanctioned so severely? The European countries didn't say nothing. The UK didn't say anything. Germany didn't say anything. France didn't say anything. Spain didn't say anything, right? They just sat and watched. And so fine, if it was some sanctions on ballistic missiles or, you know, I don't know, some other, you know, bogus things that they come up with. But who did they sanction? They sanctioned Astana Qudsi Razavi, a religious holy shrine where thousands of people from all over the world come.
Hundreds and thousands
to do pilgrimage. So why did the Europeans not say, hey, wait a minute, why are you guys sanctioning a religious institution, a blessed site where people come to do pilgrimage? Okay, another one. The United States of America sanctioned a educational institution. Let's go ahead and sanction Jamiatul Mustafa, Al-Mustafa International University, a university which has branches all across the world, including these European countries. None of these European countries bothered to say, hey, this is wrong. You are attacking a nation's religious and educational institutions based upon flawed information. This really, to me, I wanted to say was sanctions and shows the enmity that these nations have not to the Islamic Republic, but to Islam itself.
Mm-hmm. Dear listeners, we hope that you benefited and enjoyed the show today, inshallah. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is Viewpoints coming to you from IRIB English Radio.
You're the reason my life's worth living. You're the reason I'm alive. I'd be lost without you. You're the reason that I strive. You're my destiny. You're my revenue. You're the reason that I breathe. You are all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
Despite Washington's decision not to deploy Marines to Haiti after the July assassination of Haitian President Moi, the devastation of the recent 7.2 earthquake has provided U.S. leaders the cloak of humanitarian aid for doing just that. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Patrick McFarlane Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Deploys Marines to Haiti under guise of disaster relief. Stay tuned for more. Despite Washington's decision not to deploy Marines to Haiti after the July assassination of Haitian President Moi, the devastation of recent 7.2 earthquake has provided U.S. leaders the cloak of humanitarian aid for doing just that. In an effort re-established under the 2010 earthquake response moniker Joint Task Force Haiti, a detachment of roughly 200 Marines departed Camp Lejeune, North Carolina for Haiti recently. The detachment is supported by 420 sailors and several ships and aircraft from U.S. Navy and Coast Guard. The Marines' mission is to provide security for Joint Task Force Haiti, who will work to help find the stranded survivors from the disaster, deliver medical supplies, and provide direct medical assistance, unquote. The Marines will join other U.S. forces already deployed to Haiti, which include U.S. Navy P-8 Poseidon aircraft, a 14-person situational awareness team from Special Operations Command South, stationed at the U.S. Embassy, and the USNS Burlington, a fast transport vessel. Also deployed are 8 helicopters, 3 UH-60 Black Hawks, 3 CH-47 Chinooks, and 2 HH-60 Pave Hawks from Joint Task Force Bravo in Honduras to provide medical air support. 4 of those helicopters have been tasked with moving a surgical hospital to Las Cayes per request of USAID. Other forces include USS Arlington, an amphibious transport dock equipped with a surgical team and landing craft capabilities, and a number of Coast Guard assets, including 3 H-60 Jayhawk helicopters and several cutters. And yes, these forces will be equipped with plenty of COVID-19 vaccines for Haiti, a country which until Moi's assassination remained largely free of the global North COVID response. According to officials, U.S. forces are prepared to remain in Haiti for up to 4 months or more as needed. These efforts follow a pre-earthquake deployment of agents and personnel from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, both ostensible domestic policing agencies, to aid Haitian officials in the investigation of Moi's assassination. While the humanitarian goal of aiding Haiti in the wake of human catastrophe is laudable, humanitarian efforts in Haiti have a disastrous past. Indeed, Haitians are correct to identify the conceit of humanitarian assistance from a nation that has invaded, occupied, and meddled in that country for over a century to calamitous effect. Haiti is a graveyard of failed NGO projects. Perhaps no better a symbol of crumbling Haitian sovereignty is the National Palace, which since 2010 earthquake has still not been rebuilt. Surely the individual soldiers involved in these deployments act with benevolence in their hearts. Their individual work is providing and conducting direct medical care, aid and rescue and reconstruction efforts ranks among the very best things the U.S. military does. Even so, this effort comes with the caveat that it is funded at the voluntary and inflationary expense of U.S. taxpayers, a country that is nearly $30 trillion in debt. The unfortunate combined effect of these efforts will be to sink Haiti even deeper into U.S. control and exploitation. To demonstrate this point, one must look at the orchestrators of the latest U.S. relief efforts. They are the very same forces that pillaged that country in the aftermath of 2010 earthquake. Indeed, the newest iteration of Joint Task Force Haiti is led by USAID, a traditional front of the CIA that is used as the vehicle for regime change operations across the world. USAID was created in 1961 to help the United States win the hearts and minds of citizens in poor countries through civic action, economic aid, and humanitarian assistance. As a Cold War policy tool, the agency was at times used as a front for CIA operations and operatives. Among the most infamous examples was the Office of Public Safety, a USAID training program in the Southern Cone that also trained torturers. It is when USAID undertakes discrete regime change operations that it runs into trouble. Indeed, its offices of transition initiatives now seems to be competing with, or at least complementing, the CIA on high-tech propaganda and destabilization programs in Cuba, if not elsewhere as well. USAID involvement in Haiti dates back to at least early 1990s, after populist candidate Jean-Bertrand Aristide became the first democratically elected leader of that country in 1991. USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, and the American Institute for Free Labor Development, that is, AFLED, began pouring money into the country in an effort that was specifically designed to fund those sectors of the Haitian political spectrum where opposition to Aristide government could be encouraged. Soon after, in 1991, Aristide was overthrown by the U.S. in a coup d'etat. He would later tell two U.S. congressmen that he was kidnapped by U.S. troops after being told to leave the country to avoid bloodshed. In the wake of 2010 earthquake, much of the work of coordinating the foreign recovery effort fell to Cheryl Mills, the head of the Clinton State Department's Haiti Task Force, and to Rajiv Shah, the then newly appointed head of USAID, neither of which had any disaster response experience. The result was dysfunction like nothing else reconstruction officials had ever seen. USAID was utterly incapable of coordinating foreign aid groups with local and national Haitian government who were either incompetent, corrupt, or completely overwhelmed. Reconstruction efforts lacked any clear strategy. The action plan, while laying out the core priorities for Haiti's recovery, didn't go into many specifics. That left Haiti's ministries to devise their own plans. And 5 years and $13.5 billion later, $1.5 billion direct from USAID, and Haiti had cleared rubble from the streets, but had not accomplished much else. Adding insult to injury, the country was now suffering from a cholera outbreak caused by occupying UN military forces. Cholera is a disease that is effectively prevented with clean drinking water, something recovery groups were clearly unable to provide. USAID and other foreign recovery officials were quick to place the blame on the Haitian people and the Haitian government. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In one of our previous programs, we spoke about a tradition where one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was, you know, requested by the Imam alayhi salam to recite some poetry regarding Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And there we mentioned that there is tradition that the Imam himself promotes this, and this is where we will recite that particular tradition. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is reported to have said that there is none, right? Ma min ahadin. So there is nobody. So every single person who does this. It's a very general tradition. Right? There is none who recites poetry about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And then he continues, Fabaka wa abka. That is that the reciter himself cries. And he makes other people cry. Right? So there are two things here. That the reciter himself is reciting and he's understanding what he is reciting. That recital of his is, you know, such that he himself becomes tearful and starts to cry. And then also that crying results in other people crying. So he makes other people cry as well. By means of this poetry. So if a person does this, right? He recites poetry, he cries, he makes other people cry. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? So nobody does this except that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make paradise incumbent upon him, that this reciter. And then also Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will forgive this person all of his sins. So this is the importance of the remembrance of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. That it is not just something, you know, we have certain people say, oh, why do you do it every year? No. The Imams themselves will do it. The Imams themselves will continuously try and encourage the remembrance of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So that fire that is within us will be reignited and then we can find our path towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For that was the mission of Imam Husayn alayhi salam. The mission of guidance, the mission to bring people back to the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala towards the Sirat al-Mustaqim. And one of the methods that we have seen that is mentioned is the poetry. But in this tradition we see that it is specifically poetry that has been mentioned. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of those who truly remember Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government after taking almost full control